by people who are coming from Union of South Africa, the dictatorship run by our government. We're also challenged a little bit later to hear from Chileans who have suffered the most grotesque type of tortures, I suppose, is most grotesque known to humanity today, again by our CIA. The offering report is very up with cancer and given up to die. It's spread through her entire body. Chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, and her knots like rubber balls in every part of her body. And I just spoke the word and said she would be all right. There she stands, free of it today. That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty. And she's always on the top of the list of generosity, a generous socialist. And that's the key to getting health. There was no hope at all for her. If you don't believe it, you can check into her background. They had to serve our black people because none of the waiters there would serve them. Somebody had obviously given an order. So how many want trees in a land where the representative of the regime in the Union of South Africa, I hope I'm not being subjective in calling it a fascist regime. From all ostensible purposes, that's what it happens to be. A young man who had the courage, though a soldier, very, very young, had the courage to stand out from the mass and the crowd and risk certain death if he goes back, come to us today to tell us of some of the atrocities that are being conducted, that are being carried on at this very moment, because that country, Union of South Africa, is nothing more than a colony, nothing less than a colony of the U.S. corporate elite. These are very serious times. We are shaken to the roots at People's Temple with the awareness that 2 weeks ago, a beautiful black woman came here, the mayor of Myersville, Mississippi, who traveled to China with Shirley MacLaine, Unita Wright. Outside of our building, one of our good members, one of our good white field niggers, because that's what we call ourselves, she happened to be alert enough to see a person outside between our building with a tape recorder. She and another good black sister pursued the person into a car and got their license number. And through the assistant district attorney that's a member of our church, you'll hear constant dialing. By the way, our telephones pick up everything that's on our microphone. If you pick up our phones or any of our extension phones or our senior citizen homes, you can pick up the phone and hear People's Temple on them. It's a very strange situation, isn't it? I find that most interesting. If you listen very quietly, if you're on the telephone, you can hear all of our service right on the telephone. Anyway, in pursuing through the U Rental Agency, we found out that these gentlemen, one of them was a high-ranking officer in the Air Force and another in the Navy, from Kessler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi, directly responsible to Senator Stennis, chief advisor to the CIA, and one of the main fascists on the Armed Service Committee. One black woman speaking of her experiences in China, not emulating China, merely bringing out certain things that impressed her, and speaking more about a socialist solution for America. That one woman caused two high-ranking people to get temporary duty status and be sent by Senator Stennis to San Francisco, California, to do whatever they had in mind with one humble black woman. America is not in a very good state of affairs. Last night, Yvonne Golden called me. I'm so glad she's here. Said they're going to take my job. Not that she would care if her duty was done, because she's always been brave enough to do what she had to do. And they had told her because she supported someone, a communist worker, Mr. Miller, who I voted for and this entire church voted for the school board, because she, what she does, we believe in Mrs. Golden. And I said, oh, no, they won't fire you. I don't think they want all of People's Temple down in the school board. Please. They had the nerve to say to her, the most progressive school in this entire district, 100 and some of the students, high school students, are members of our church. And some bigot, some honky bigot out on the 7000 block of Geary said that the children there were not capable of being exposed to a Bakke rally. A rally that was necessary, if anything was necessary, to freedom in American life, to protest the fact that now it will be almost impossible. Even the Los Angeles Times said that our college graduate schools will be lily white by next year because of the Bakke decision. And they were going to take her job because her students were being exposed to civil rights. I called Dr. Gooseby and I told Dr. Goodland, I said, Don, let me tell you, I'm mad. And I said, I don't want this woman's job. You better not even try to take her job. Dr. Gooseby assured me, and so did Dr. Goodland, that it will not happen. Because I said, you don't want that kind of combustion, because I'll raise old Ned all kinds of hell if they do. We must stand up. We must stand up for people like that. There are too few Yvonne Goldens. There are too few in our country today. Even in this city of San Francisco, we notice the conspiracy of the so-called counter-revolutionary front that killed Dr. Letelier, Orlando Letelier, the defense minister of Chile, and brought down the Cuban Airlines with 73 youngsters, 11 medical students in our agriculture mission that perished. Not our own members of our church, but Guyanese, precious Guyanese young people that were killed. And now they're finding that 18 people that have been arrested. Their organization, their counter-revolutionary clique, was formed here in June in San Francisco. In San Francisco, because Art Rosenbaum sent so many tickets, our courtesy tickets, to our people, as I said, right in this city just a few days ago. Naturally, we sent our black members because we are all one. In this city, our black people at that affair, I was glad I wasn't there, or you'd have found me in jail today. But I've been a pacifist all my life, but I'm having a hard time with it anymore. They ignored all of our black people entirely. Would not serve them. Here, the great Progress, the great newspaper that's fastly becoming a daily in this town. Black people were not served. And as I understand, Professor Tropp, a Jewish member, had to get up and serve our black people. Finest black people that you could find in this entire United States were there. But they were ignored by that entire affair. It's time that we forget our petty differences. And I hear so many things about I'm this kind of a socialist, or I'm a Maoist socialist, or I'm a USSR socialist, or I'm a socialist worker, or I'm a people socialist, or I'm a Trotskyite socialist. I'm for anybody whose rights are being taken away from them. Peace. And so we pledge to this young man the same kind of strength. We're much more observant today, if anyone is watching you, and we do have more connections than the usual group. I imagine we're quite an enigma. One congressperson said to me on Tuesday, he said, they don't know what the hell to do with People's Temple. They have never seen several thousand church people that are all radical socialists. Please. So without further ado, first of our guests today, Bill Anderson, is on a tour around the country sponsored primarily by Amnesty International and the American Friends Service Committee. He was born in Cape Town, South Africa, grew up there, and attended the University of Cape Town, from which he was drafted into the Army. While in the military, Bill was a part of the illegal invasion force that occupied Angola during the last days of the revolution there, and also was stationed in Nambia. But I think it doesn't. That's the chap said. I'll, what do we care about that? He can tell us about it. We admit we don't know what we ought to know about Africa, so we'll finally get informed. It's the area just above the Union of South Africa that has been taken over and occupied by Union of South Africa between there and Angola, in which it was used as a base by our government and our CIA and the colony, the Union of South Africa, to try to overthrow the people's government of Angola. But anyway, while this young man was on duty in Angola, he witnessed many atrocities and tortures. I'm sure he can tell us about it. After his first tour of duty, the South African Army splits up a person's time in the service. Bill went to London. While in London, he heard some people speaking in defense of South Africa. He could not take it and started speaking out and telling the truth, and has been doing so ever since. 21 years of age. Bill was one of the first to break the story regarding the South African Army's atrocities and testified to the entire United Nations against South Africa within the last 2 months. He is a supporter of the Marxist SWAPU Liberation Army in this Namibia, Southwest African People's Organization, and an outspoken opponent to the racist apartheid South African government. I don't know whether you can possibly know how it feels to be 21 and uprooted from your country, and is he safe in America? I wish we could keep such precious young people here, as we wanted to keep Orlando before he went back to Washington and was killed on our embassy square. But we give the CIA notice. Don't mess with these people. Don't mess with anybody else that comes through our ranks, because you'll have to kill us all. Peace. If he goes back to the corrupt fascist regime of the Union of South Africa, he faces certain death. I think we should give a good hand for a 21-year-old that has that kind of guts. Will you come?
I was conscripted into the South African Army in July last year. I had 5 months training in Grahamstown in South Africa, and then in November last year was sent up into southern Angola. I spent 3 months in the south of Angola. We weren't involved in the main heat of the war that was then taking place further north. I then spent 2 months on the west, far westernmost camp on the Namibian-Angolan border. And then during May and June this year, I was involved in what is called Operation Cobra, and I'd like to say a few words about my experiences during this time. Namibia, or as it is known by the South African government, still Southwest Africa, lies between South Africa on the west coast of Africa and between Angola above it. The people of Namibia have a long history of a peaceful struggle to try and get some freedom for themselves, some say in their own government. It was in 1966 that the Southwest African People's Organization decided that the only way that they were going to free themselves was to fight for it. And so they have been fighting a guerrilla war in northern Namibia since 1966. The operation I was involved in moved into a fairly small area. It involved 5 battalions, that's about 4,000 men, and our orders were to clear the area completely of guerrilla activity. For the first 4 weeks, each battalion worked on its own, sending out its own patrols, and at that stage bringing in anyone that was vaguely suspect. The first 2 prisoners brought into our camp were suspects on the line that they were walking in the same direction in which guerrillas were believed to be moving. I saw these men being brought into camp, being beaten with fists, with rifles, their bodies burnt with cigarettes, their mouths filled with sand, generally very roughly treated by the ordinary South African troops, whose average age is about 18 or 19, and this done in front of and with the encouragement of senior army officers. The men were then taken into an interrogation tent and tortured using electric shock treatment from a field telephone. And for the 2 months of May and June this year, I went to bed every single night with the screams of these men being tortured. After the first 4 weeks in the operation, I think the authorities realized they weren't getting anywhere with the operation. So they brought the five battalions together and involved them in a very systematic sweep of a very small area. And at this stage, orders were given that every single male adult, whether suspect or not, was to be brought in for interrogation and torture. And when I say adult, some of those brought into our camp were as young as about 13. The other standing order was that if anyone ran away at any stage, they were to be shot, and you shot to kill. So the situation for the people that live there, it is the Ovambo people that live in this area. They are the largest population group in Namibia, and most of them are subsistence farmers. If any of them happen to be working their land and an army patrol approaches, they have two choices: either to stand their ground and then be taken in and tortured, or to run away and be shot. And this is the way the military is dealing with the people of Namibia, who they claim they are defending. I'm talking about an operation involving 4,000 troops. There are at least 45,000 troops in Namibia today. I could go on for hours talking about the various atrocities being carried out. One man, for instance, was handcuffed, his arms hooked over a branch of a tree, with his feet dangling about 2 foot off the ground, and a fire was lit under him. In the afternoons, an interrogation used to take place where they would duck men's heads into buckets of water and hold them under until their bodies went limp, pull them out, and then beat them until they revived. There was no intention to, by any subtle means, to get any information out of people. It was a direct bullying. I don't believe that the South African people think that black people deserve any subtle treatment. They looked upon them as savages. They couldn't even accept, when I spoke to various people, that South Africa is minority ruled. This is something they just cannot understand, that black people, that blacks are people. They are standing there with the old myth, the myth that has been very successfully built up by the South African government, that it is a fact for, I'd say, 99% of white South Africans, that majority rule means chaos, communism, and every white having their throat slit. They are fighting against this every single day, and any man standing up for his freedom is a threat to them. From that point of view, I think it is pretty obvious that the South African government is not, of its own free will, going to give away an inch of its power or its land and its domination. And the only way that change is going to come in South Africa is through an armed struggle. And I believe that change is coming very soon. I would like to say a bit about my own reactions to what has been going on in South Africa since June the 16th. But before I do that, I would like to trace very briefly the kind of life one can expect being black to have growing up in South Africa in an urban area. The type of life that the 1,227 black students who were gunned down by the police in the last couple of months, the type of life that they would have been expected to live. Even before a child is born in South Africa, it is more than likely that his parents will not be living together. His mother will work as a servant in some wealthy white home and live in the backyard of her employer's house. Her husband will live in segregated barracks, either on a mine or in a township closest to the industry in which he works. They will not be allowed to live together. If they are lucky, they will see each other once a week. When the child is born, there will be no money for any decent medical care. As it is, there are not enough medical staff to look after the black people. There is only one doctor for every 400,000 blacks in South Africa. Because there is no money, they will not be able to feed the child properly. And every other black child in South Africa dies before the age of five of malnutrition. One out of every two children in South Africa die before the age of five. The parents will bend over backwards to try and send their child to school. And if they do manage to get that money together, they will send their child to an overpopulated school where they have not the ability to get a decent education. I think I must just point out here that whites get a free education in South Africa, whereas blacks have to pay for their education. At school, a child will be taught under an education system that, by order of the Bantu Education Act, is very much inferior to the education the whites get, and it's an education that continually stresses that blacks must realize that they must not expect any equal opportunities in South Africa, that they have a very special role to play in that country. And I think when we're talking about that special role, we have to look at the role that the Dutch Reformed Church plays in South Africa, because the Afrikaner Church has legitimized everything that the South African government is doing, and it continually stresses this master-servant relationship that they have interpreted out of the Bible. At the same time, the whole communist threat is blown into such an incredible paranoia. While I was up in Angola on Christmas Day, we were preached a sermon by one of these ministers who was talking about peace on earth, but here we were fighting, and he explained it as if we were fighting the communists, and communists don't believe in God, and therefore we were fighting a religious war. I think this is a very important aspect of where South Africa stands today, that the South African government is not only interested in the politics and economy of the country, they are fighting for their cultural identity, and they'll be very strongly backed up by this religion. To get back to a black child schooling in South Africa, by the age of 13, his parents will more than likely not have any money left to send to keep him in school. In fact, only 12% of those children starting in school get anywhere near a secondary school. So at the age of 13, he will go out and join the ranks of the over 4 million unemployed blacks in South Africa. At the same time, there are 40,000 white jobs that are empty. That is, jobs that involve a skill that blacks are not allowed to take. Blacks are starved from being educated by giving skills. They are not allowed to hold skilled jobs. They are only there for their cheap manual labor. If a child disagrees with anything that is going on, if he's only involved in something like a peaceful protest, as so many of them were involved in Soweto and the other townships around South Africa during the last couple of months, he can be expected to be gunned down without even having said a word. The police just move in and gun these people down. If he wants to organize anything, if he tries to really fight for his freedom, he can be held under any number of acts, the latest being the Internal Security Act, under which just a member of the police force, not even a magistrate, a member of the security police, if he regards a person to be a threat to the security of the state, a security policeman can detain a person first for a year, and that year can be renewed for as long as the authorities like. The person will be detained in solitary confinement without ever being brought to trial, without being allowed to see a lawyer, a magistrate, no one. This is the type of conditions that people have to fight for their freedom in South Africa. To get to what exactly is happening in South Africa at the moment, I'd like to mention a clipping of a television newsreel that a London television crew were able to make when they sneaked into Soweto. They interviewed a little kid, a black kid, about 13 years old, was standing with a stone in his hand, and across the road there were a row of policemen. And the interviewer said, "Don't you think you're wasting your time? Here are all these guns against you and you've only got a stone in your hand." And this little kid said, "They can shoot me. That doesn't matter, because we are right and we are going to win." And this is the type of feeling you have in South Africa at the moment. The people of South Africa have a long history of a peaceful struggle to try and free themselves, and every single time they have been put down and pushed back into their very oppressed role. I think we have a stance by the people of South Africa now where it is very clear that they are not going to be pushed back again. They know exactly where they are now, exactly where they are going, and nothing is going to push them down again. From this, I think it is very clear that when we look at South Africa today, we only have two roads left on which we can go. We can either support Forster and his fascist regime, or we can totally support the liberation struggle. In that respect, I'd like to mention a little bit about my views on what Mr. Kissinger is doing in South Africa, and what the United States, Britain, France, and the other Western powers are doing in South Africa. I think at this stage I must make it very clear that the only reason that Forster is in power, that the only reason the racists can stay where they are, is because the economy of South Africa is propped up by the Western imperialist powers. When we're dealing with Mr. Kissinger, we are dealing with a person who 3 years ago made a statement regarding the people of Chile, and he said, if the people of Chile decide for themselves that they want a communist state, that is an irresponsible action, and the people of the United States have every reason to step in and stop that. That is the type of person we are dealing with. That, I think, is a State Department line where they are, if they can possibly help it, not going to lose their contacts and their ties with South Africa, and exactly how they are bolstering up the South African government and pulling the strings and dictating to the people exactly what is going on. In the last year or so, the South African economy has had a couple of blows to it. They've been doubling their defense budget every single year, and with a drop in the price of gold, they've lost a lot of foreign currency. So what we find happening is that over the past couple of years, United States banks have been involved in over $2 billion worth of short-term loans to the South African government. And only in the last couple of weeks, again, we see Chase Manhattan, First National City, Manufacturers Hanover Trust, and Morgan Guarantee, and a number of other European American banks involved in somewhere between $110 and $300 million loans South Africa, directly to the South African government. And I think it can be argued that this money is going directly to the South African Defense Force. When you realize that over 300 of the major United States corporations are in South Africa, you must realize that one of the main reasons that they are there is that South Africa is the only place in the world where they come out with between 18 and 20% profits. And the only reason they come out with those profits is because they are exploiting the cheap labor of the South African system. It is in their interest to keep the racist regime in power, because only in that way will they make these profits. And it is only with these profits that they bring back to South Africa, to the United States, plus the tax credits that the taxpayers of this country pay to them, that they can then further exploit the people of their own country. When Kissinger met South African Prime Minister Forster in Zurich in September this year, a story leaked out that up till this time has not been denied by any United States authorities. A story to the effect that if the South African troops were to withdraw from Namibia and a moderate black rule was set up, then the United States would arm and train a black Namibian army. In the June issue of the Military Review, there is an article talking about the possibility of the United States setting up a naval base in the so-called independent state of the Transkei. To me, these are two very ominous facts. If we look back to how the United States first got involved in Vietnam by sending in military advisors, I think the United States is on a course at the moment where they are going to get themselves deeply involved in a very horrible state of affairs as regarding Southern Africa. I think Southern Africa is going to become a crisis point in the world in the next 5 years. I think it is a time now that people should be looking at this and not wait till the crunch really comes, because something can be done now. When we look at the struggle that is going on in South Africa, we must see that that struggle, under its manifesto, the Freedom Charter, drawn up in 1955 by the African National Congress, made it very clear what the people are fighting for. They were fighting for a new state where there will be equal opportunity and freedom for all. A state where anyone, regardless of his color, of his creed, will, if he is prepared to participate constructively in a new state, will have freedom and equality in that country. I think it is very clear that the liberation struggle is fighting the system and not the people. As I said, the liberation struggle is fighting for freedom in South Africa. And I'd like to spend a couple of moments talking about what freedom for the Southern African people means. When, in their second presidential debate, Mr. Carter and Mr. Ford stood up and talked in lofty terms about freedom for the people in South Africa, and Mr. Ford went on with what I think is a fascist statement of saying that he regarded himself having responsibilities as being leader of the free world, I think we must realize that this view of freedom that has been sold to the United States is totally out of tune where the people of South Africa are now. Because freedom for the people of South Africa means a freedom to decide who they want to talk to, a freedom to decide whom they want to deal with, and a freedom to decide what society they will form and what will take place in South Africa. It has got nothing to do with anyone in any Western power trying to manipulate the scenes, trying for their own greed to continue to pull the strings in South Africa. The people of South Africa are very clear what they want. They are going to get it soon, and that freedom will very soon be theirs. Thank you.
I could not help but think that might be one of our sons. I don't think you have any idea what's riding on his shoulders. I don't think some of the young people in this church have any idea what kind of courage it takes for him to do what he's doing. His life is not very safe, to say the least. Leaves me speechless. You can tell he speaks from the heart. There are various movements today that would distract us, trying to make us think that no one but someone that's black or Indian as our background can understand our problem. But to me, he spoke as well as any field nigger could speak. As soon as they bring the money for him to carry on his program as he sees fit, we do not put any pressure upon you to stay. Dr. Khan is still waiting the Chilean refugees. They're more than welcome to stay. We love having you, and we pledge our support to you. We pledge our support to you, son. So we're waiting the Chilean refugees. And while we're doing so, would you sing something? But don't sing anything like Fill My Cup, because nobody fills our goddamn cup. We have to do the filling. I don't like any songs that emphasize, fill my cup, fill me. There's nothing out there to fill me. We are the people. God is in us. Socialism's in us. And what he said about the church in South Africa is no different than the church in America. The same situation. Yesterday at the opening of Soul Park, there was only People's Temple there. And I don't want the world to be confused or him. I want to go down and see him before he leaves to pledge. If anyone bothers him, I'm going to come at any point where he may be geographically. But I want this to be said. We are not like other churches. I hate the name of church because it doesn't even fit. We were the only group there. There's only one minister I have any respect for, and he can't bring one of his people when he comes. They won't follow him. That's Cecil Williams. We were the only people at the celebration of Soul Park yesterday. We're the only people at Bakke demonstration. We're the only people that will be there Tuesday for William Farr as they send him back to jail. Peace. Religion is the opiate of the people. I'm not religious. I hate religion, and we'll never have freedom till the damn thing is done away with. Sing a solo or something, sing something, but get the words, let freedom's light shine on you or something. Are united forever in friendship and labor, but for God's sakes, no more anything with religious tones today. Waiting for a few of the guests, so I'd like for just a few minutes, three or four minutes or 5 minutes, if Yvonne Golden, who we feel at least we had a victory by maintaining her job, which is maintaining a voice of liberty second to none in this town. She's a fighter. We're always happy to have Yvonne Golden, the principal of Opportunity High, number 2 high school, where over 100 of our own youngsters in People's Temple attend high school. We're so happy to have her. Say a few remarks, will you, Yvonne? We're so happy to have you.
Reverend Jones, Mrs. Jones, and this lovely congregation, every time I come before you, or every time I've been here, I've always wanted to cry. I come in and I get tears. I hear Ms. Bill Anderson, the young man from South Africa, make the remarks. And that's the comfort that I have, that there are those people who are just as dedicated and just as committed as I am. They're just as committed to speaking out against all oppressive forces, that we will not sit silently by and let brutality and inhumaneness, poverty, illness, and what have you, take over a people in order for a few wealthy people to reap the benefits. Thank you. When I look to my left and see these beautiful people from Chile, I want to say to you, welcome, brothers and sisters, welcome. Just quickly, I don't want you to think too much, because I know Jim, and I know what Jim would do. And I don't want you to worry too much about me, because I'm just a soldier in this army for the liberation and freedom. Our army, Jim has said, our army for liberation and freedom of mankind. I did receive a letter that was directed to the superintendent of schools protesting my appearance along with you and your children at a protest meeting of the Barker decision. It also talked about the distribution of communist literature at that rally, and it talked about my support of a candidate for the Board of Education who is a Communist Labor Party member. But the horrible thing about that letter, and the thing that hit me most, it talked about my children and your children at Opportunity 2. It said that those children were least likely to have the ability to disseminate information and to make judgment. And it said that the children of Opportunity 2 were not from a stable family background from which they were able to weigh any kind of information. And I'm mad. I'm mad. I am angry. Those children mean everything in the world to me, and that job is secondary. It means everything in the world to me that those children aren't labeled, they aren't categorized, and they aren't taken for granted that they are retarded, that they are neglected. Those my students, your children, are exciting. They are curious. They are brilliant. And they are loving. And to me, that's the most important thing in the world. And on Tuesday, the Board of Education will meet in executive session. Thank you, darling. Thank you, darling. They will discuss me, but I want to say to them that I'm tired of this harassment, and I want it to cease and desist. And I want to say to you that I love you, and I've received several letters from the people in San Francisco saying that they have read about what you are doing and what we did in terms of the Barker decision. I have the letters at school. Anybody may see them. And I love you, and I want you to continue what you're doing, because what you're doing is right. And we love all of you, and we love Jim Jones. Thank you very much.
Before we introduce Dr. Kahn, there's something that one of our youngsters would like to do. I think one of our youngsters is going to introduce a number to our Chilean brothers and sisters in Spanish at this moment. By the way, the young man from South Africa who has a death threat on his life and has received many already, I didn't go into that. He didn't want to talk too much about his own suffering, but he left the church, he said. He had never felt there was anything worthy about religion or the church. I have never seen or felt anything like this, he told the group down there. Tim Carter's written it up. I've never felt anything like it in my life. He kept saying, this is incredible, incredible. He He said he would be in touch. Where he goes to Nebraska, and there have been all kinds of threats on his life, all kinds of things done to him, and they promised if they get him back to the Union of South Africa, he will be killed, and charged with high treason, and be summarily executed. He left with tears in his eyes, and he said there was no way he could describe how much he was touched, and I know we felt even more so about him. Joan, dear.
Quiero decirles que nuestro líder ha dado inspiración de cantar canciones que tienen significación y sentido. Y ella tiene 3 años y va a cantar Nosotros nos venceremos en español.
How old is she for the blue in English? I speak Portuguese, and I think you said 3. And she's going to sing and in Spanish. Now she's never been in any place where Spanish is. She's one of our children that was adopted here by one of our families and grew up in San Francisco. Introduce Dr. Khan, who needs no introduction and who we love dearly. Let us sing the theme song of our heart, United Forever in Friendship and Labor. United forever in friendship and labor, a mighty people shall ever endure. The great socialist union shall live through the ages, a dream of the people, their fortress secure. Long live, O Soviet motherland, 'twas built by the people's mighty hand. Long live her people, united and free. Long live this socialist. Salute your neighbor with a kiss and embrace. Love is what we need.